It's been confirmed the Grenfell Tower fire started in a Hotpoint fridge freezer. The cladding and insulation on the building has failed safety tests, and police say they're considering manslaughter charges. Jay Lofthouse is a former firefighter who lives on the top floor of a tower block in Salford. A fire was contained there 2 weeks ago, and he says he's reassured by extra steps being taken after the tragedy in London.
There's lots of scaremongering going on. I've had two ladies come up to me now who have been here some time who are thinking of moving out because they've been told their families are at risk. Rubbish. The local management company Pendleton Together and Salford Council right now are jumping through hoops.
Some breaking news in the last hour. British tennis number 3 Dan Evans says he's failed a drugs test for cocaine. He was already an injury doubt for Wimbledon with a calf problem. Theresa May has defended her plans for EU citizens living in the UK after Brexit, describing them as fair and serious. It follows criticism from the president of the European Council, who thinks they are below expectations. A former leader of the Ulster Volunteer Force has admitted 200 terror charges. 45-year-old Gary Haggerty pleaded guilty to offences including 5 murders and counts of directing terrorism. The so-called supergrass is expected to get a reduced sentence in exchange for cooperating with future trials. Padraig O'Murray is a solicitor for some of the families of the victims.
They've been let down by the justice system in the past. They had no confidence, literally no confidence. And there's still a long way to go, and I've no doubt their frustrations ahead. So it's been very difficult for them, but I suppose this is a step, but only a small step in the process.
A dad who fought a long-running legal battle over taking his child on a term time holiday has been found guilty. John Platt, who's previously taken his case all the way to the Supreme Court, has been ordered to pay £2,000 in costs. And the White House has responded after Johnny Depp asked a crowd at Glastonbury when was the last time an actor assassinated a president. It says President Trump condemns violence in all forms. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course, I knew too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international community. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth as the village. Yes.
That is my hope. What's yours?
I'd like to be the first man on the moon.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. One of the most powerful forces infiltrating our political parties, dragging democracy through the dirt, is 300 years old tomorrow. Last week we looked at the century since the Balfour Declaration, the 50 years since Israel's Six-Day War, where they grabbed what's still known today as the occupied territories of Palestine. Tonight, on a related theme of political manipulation, we look at another centenary. That's 300 years ago tomorrow. The first Grand Lodge of English Freemasons was formed 200 years ago. The Masons themselves deny it. What's the evidence that they're part of a mystery religion which targets businesses, the armed forces, politics, and people of faith, going back thousands of years? Also, Israel and 9/11, following on from last week's interview with the Reverend Stephen Sizer, author of Christian Zionism. Now, he posted up a link to an article, Israel Did 9/11, All the Proof in the World. And someone else who agrees with him is the former head of the US Army War College, no less. But what about the bigger picture? Is the war on terror actually meant to be won, or is it meant to go on forever? Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, a post-election State of the City report from Jack Hazeldean of Bristol People's Assembly, as well as a look at how TMO management, which seemed to be so instrumental in the Grenfell Tower fire, was blocked by plucky Bristol tenants in 2009 here in Bristol, and which Lib Dems Mike Popham and Cheryl Ann were pushing these TMOs in Bristol 8 years ago. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again on bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, before all that, Russia has been targeting US jets now in Syria after the US shot down the first Assad regime warplane this week.
Yeah, well, they haven't actually shot any down yet, as far as I know, but it may happen. The Australian government withdrew from the, you know, withdrew their planes from overflying Syria, but they've now reneged on that and they're going to carry on flying. We're on the edge of a potential shooting war here between Russia and NATO.
Well, maybe you missed it then, because it was last Sunday, a Syrian aircraft but
they haven't shot down a NATO plane yet in retaliation.
What they're doing is they're threatening to shoot down.
Well, they're saying that we're not playing games anymore. You know, you've shot down one of our planes, you've attacked us three times now, if you come over the border, you know, we're not going to guarantee that we're not going to shoot you down. And in actual fact, they've got no right to be flying over Syria at all in international law, none whatsoever. So the Syrian army and their Russian allies will be perfectly within their rights to shoot down any NATO planes or drones which are
under,
on Syrian airspace.
What about airspace. Under US law?
Well, under US law, they're supposed to go to Congress to get a war vote.
But who's going to make them? Who's going to make them? They could do what they want, these guys.
Well, what will happen is if they carry on the way they're going, the Russians will shoot down their plane, and it could be an RAF plane that gets shot down, and then the British, the Americans and etc. will have to confront the fact that they haven't got international law on their side, and they can carry on defying international law, but they'll never get a resolution through the UN Security Council, and we're all off to war. And then it becomes a question of who's got the best aircraft.
Okay,
and
so
I suspect the Russians are in a better position to fight than NATO.
The hotline set up between Russia and the US has been suspended. All kinds of airborne vehicles, including aircraft and drones. The International Coalition, inverted commas there, detected to the west of the Euphrates River, will be tracked by Russian SAM systems as air targets. That's what they're now saying.
The
shooting down of the Syrian jet last Sunday, I mean, effectively, that Syrian jet is attacking ISIS. So by shooting it down, the Americans are ISIS's air support, aren't they?
They are. And, of course, that's exactly the role that the NATO Air Force played at Deir ez-Zor. The RAF sent one of their little drones. 80-some-odd Syrian soldiers were killed. ISIS took advantage and tried to seize the position. Eventually, the airstrikes from the Russians drove them back. But we are, in fact, Al-Qaeda, ISIS's air force. And the Russians are getting bored of trying to tell people this. And they've been trying to avoid a conflict with us. But, I mean, they've made it couldn't make it clearer now. If you come in and try and attack our forces, we're going to shoot you down.
Washington has said the jet dropped bombs near the US-backed rebel forces.
Well, in actual fact, the Kurdish forces have said that they don't say that's true at all. They say that it wasn't attacking them.
And the US did not, according to the Russians, use its hotline with Russia ahead of the downing of the Syrian government warplane, said the Russian Foreign Ministry, which accused the US of a deliberate failure to make good on its commitment.
Well, the same thing happened at Deir ez-Zor. They said it was an accident, but in actual fact, when the Russians phoned up the hotline, there was no reply.
Is it fair to say that as the Russians and the Syrian government take back the Syrian country, as that gets closer and closer, so the tensions between the US and Russia are greater?
They are, and there's a potential here for NATO aircraft to be shot down. Now, it may be that if a NATO aircraft is shot down, and I think they should be shot down, I think the Russians have been very silly not to shoot them down, then NATO is put in a position where they're the same as the Russians.
Surely they're much wiser not to shoot them down, because
Well, that's why they haven't done it.
They're being wise. They're saying, well, look, OK, so you can shoot down some of our planes and some of our allies' planes, and we will just have to absorb that, because everyone can then see who's the aggressor here.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that you can do a bit of that, but eventually you then have to say, no, we're finishing this war off now.
At what point do you think the Russians will strike back at the Americans then?
Well, they've already flagged up that they could strike back at any moment from here on in. It may be that they're prepared to take more punishment without striking back.
I mean,
but what they've said is, we reserve the right to strike.
Surely
back
what's
here.
Going on here is the big superpowers are both having a go at the minor parties here, not the superpowers. So they're actually shying away quite rightly from direct confrontation with each other.
Well, that's true, and let's hope that they carry on doing so. But I think basically the Western position here, and the position of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other and terrorist supporting states like Turkey, is no longer acceptable. We've had hundreds of thousands of people killed, millions of people displaced. The Syrian army have fought a magnificent battle, and it's time that they had their victory.
Also in that region, the Saudi government has demanded that Qatar stop broadcasting Al Jazeera, so it does look as if our theory about the attack on Qatar's diplomatically was really aimed at their broadcasting service.
Well, that's one of the things they're trying to, I mean, can you imagine trying to say, what you've got to do, Britain, is you've got to close down the BBC because we're bored of you telling lies. Can you imagine if somebody made that demand of Britain, whether we would give in to that? Would we?
Also, Turkey has rejected Saudi Arabia and their allies' demands over a Qatari airbase among 13 conditions set by the Gulf allies in exchange for ending the Qatar economic blockade. Well, actually, what the Qataris have said, I mean, this really does look as if it's going to run this, because the Qataris have said at the very first, we will not negotiate with anybody until you end this economic blockade, then we will start to talk to you.
Well, one of the things, the knock-on effects of this in Syria, is that the various jihadi factions that are fighting the Syrian government are now actually at daggers drawn with each other, because there's some supported by the Qataris, essentially the Al-Qaeda Muslim Brotherhood ones, and other more loony ones like ISIS are supported by the Saudis. But they're actually, the Saudi-Qatari split
has also messed
things up for them.
That Baghdadi, apparently, the ISIS leader, has been killed by the Russians in an airstrike. ISIS may be leaderless and facing a loss of Mosul, but the group will fight on. So who's running ISIS at the moment?
Well, that's a very good question, because, of course, what the Syrian general staff, the Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff and the Iraqi general staff believe is that ISIS is essentially a creature of the Saudis and NATO. And they're not wrong, because, of course, as the Russians pointed out, Bilal Erdogan's son, was very much involved in buying oil from them, huge amounts of oil, which were then shipped to Israel. And, of course, the Israelis have admitted this week that they are, in fact, supporting rebels inside Syria.
Also, on the periphery of this, although absolutely horrendous nevertheless, is the whole situation in Yemen. We've now got outbreaks of cholera there. Middle East Eye reporting at least 20 deaths and something which are definitely attributed to cholera, and something like 3,500 suspected cholera cases reported in a single day now.
Yes, and the British government's position is gung-ho. We've got our military personnel embedded with the Saudis, helping them destroy the civilian population of Yemen. I'm not a pacifist, Tony. If any British military personnel are killed in Saudi Arabia doing that sort of work, I will cheer. Kill them up.
Parents, ISIS has been over in the Philippines, apparently been involved there, ambushing the Philippine army south of Marawi amid heavy clashes in the city. So, I mean, we heard a bit about a jailbreak. ISIS turned up and sprung a load of people from jail. Obviously, this is the same sort of thing that they did in, before ISIS was supposedly around, over in Libya. Where they go is they find a whole load of people who are in jail, they spring them from jail, they give them some food, some guns, and they say, come and be our army.
Well, interesting enough, Duterte in the Philippines has started to take an independent line, talking to the Chinese about settling the South China Sea dispute, talking to the Russians about cooperation, and then suddenly, ISIS turn up, and he's got to fight. I mean, what the Philippine general staff believe is that ISIS is being run by the Americans, and the Americans then say, you need us to help you deal with ISIS. This is the game they play. They claim that they're not on ISIS's side. They use ISIS in order to infiltrate themselves into... See, the American military were kicked out of the Philippines in the Democratic Revolution at the end of the 80s. and they want their way back in because they see it as a crucial. Don't forget, the Philippines was a US colony, and there's a huge history of them dominating the Philippines, and they see it as a big aircraft carrier to threaten the Chinese with. But Duterte, whatever his faults, is trying to pursue an independent policy, and if you try and do that, then ISIS turn up, and then you can't. And then, of course, what the Philippine military believe is that ISIS are being supported by the Americans, and they're right, of course.
Well, what the official US line is that they are supporting some of the rebels over in Syria, but not all of them. But there's a magazine called The American Conservative. They've literally come out this week saying America is arming terrorists in Syria. Three-term Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, a member of both the Armed Services and Foreign Affairs Committee, has now proposed legislation that would prohibit any US assistance to terrorist organizations in Syria.
Yes, and she got 13 votes in the Congress. It was all voted down. Tulsi Gabbard is a very interesting character. I think she's shaping up to be potentially the Democratic nominee for president next time.
The interesting thing is that the American right is actually applauding what she's doing.
Well, what we're seeing is that people of good conscience on both left and right are recognising what's wrong. And it's not about left and right, it's about right and wrong. Why are we still supporting jihadi terrorists? We supposedly did that in the 1980s, and then we learned our lesson when they carried out 9/11. Except we haven't learned our lesson. We're still arming and training them. British Special Forces, SAS, are based in Syria at Al Tanf at the minute, training jihadis how to blow things up. There's a question mark about what happened in Manchester. Were the people who built the bomb, were they trained by our own special forces? Because it's quite possible they were in Libya.
Well, the Associated Press, I mentioned Yemen a minute ago, but they're also saying this week that yesterday, Maggie Michael at the Associated Press is talking about the secret prisons in Yemen, where the United Arab Emirates officers are doing the torturing and the US CIA are doing the actual interrogation. Hundreds of men swept up in a hunt for Al-Qaeda militants have disappeared into a secret network of prisons in southern Yemen.
And it won't be just Al-Qaeda. That's the cover story. They've probably got Houthi militants in there as well, haven't they? The people that they're actually fighting. And, of course, the torture is as American as apple pie. The School of the Americas in Georgia trained all the main torturers in Latin America. Noriega, General Galtieri, all of these people were graduates of the torture school run by the US.
These secret prisons are becoming a kind of, almost like something we expect now in the so-called war on terror. Excuse me. Secret prisons in Yemen, are, according to the Associated Press, are inside military bases. They're in ports. They're at an airport. They're in private villas and even a nightclub. Some detainees have been flown to an Emirati base across the Red Sea in Eritrea, according to the Yemen's Interior Minister Hussein Arab and others. Several US defence officials speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss the topic told Associated Press that American forces do participate in these interrogations of detainees in UK. I mean, this seems to be very much like this rendition project. We thought that had been looked at and that they weren't going to do that anymore. They're clearly doing it here in Yemen.
Well, that's right. They've been doing it. There's a huge gulag all over the world of secret prisons where people are held with no legal basis whatsoever and tortured by our people. And we claim the moral high ground. As I say, it's the British SAS are currently in Syria training jihadis how to blow things up and kill people. Is that wise or sensible or moral?
Meanwhile, over in Korea, the new South Korean president has said US is only supposed to be installing one THAAD missile. So he was saying originally he didn't want any THAAD missiles. He's now given in a little bit and said the Americans can have one THAAD missile over in South Korea, which these missiles will be aimed at North Korea, won't they?
Well, the problem is that the missiles are essentially aimed at China. They wouldn't. I mean, for example, if the North Koreans were going to use a nuclear bomb to bomb Seoul, it's only about 10 kilometres from the border. They're not a missile isn't going to stop that. So in other words, what it really does is it allows the Americans to present the Chinese, as they've already presented the Russians, with the potential for a first strike, which as the South Korean president knows very well that this is provocative. And in actual fact, he won the election saying, we don't want these things, take them away. But of course, the Americans are saying, what do you mean, take them away? We're your big brother.
In Pakistan,
you've got to have this stuff.
In Pakistan, the Pakistani government and the Pakistani military are saying, we've had enough of these drone strikes on our soil. We're not going to tolerate any more, they say.
Well, indeed, they've been saying that all along, and it's pretty similar to what the Russians and the Syrians are saying in Syria. You come and attack us again, and we're going to fight back, because we've been very, very patient with you, but now we're losing patience, and maybe it's time for you to pay the price.
I suppose we've been
the military price of your adventures.
Spiralling around this war on terror, we're ending up where it all started in Afghanistan. A car bomb today has arrived in Afghanistan, hit in Afghanistan. 34 people are dead and 60 wounded. Now, the most recent one, which was in Kabul, Martin, was very notable in that although it killed nearly 100 people, it didn't kill a single person who was part of the occupying forces.
Well, listen, I don't know exactly who's planting the bombs in Afghanistan or what their tactics are. You see, there's always a problem that one of the counterinsurgency tactics that is pursued is to carry out evil attacks, basically counter-gang theory, and then you blame the Taliban for carrying out the attacks. I don't know. All deaths are regrettable. We shouldn't really be fighting these wars, and our intelligence services are way out of control. They've been encouraging terrorism for years. Many of those people need to go to prison.
Yeah, it's amazing how easy we forget these. This was on the 1st of June this month. In Kabul, this truck bomb killed nearly 100 people, something like 250 injured, but it didn't kill any occupation forces. It does look as if this is actually aimed at the domestic population, but it's supposed to be an attack which was by the domestic population. There was then a massive demonstration afterwards at which several more people were killed. At their funerals, there was another bomb and another attack where more were killed. So these things, I mean, particularly the funeral attacks, seem to be something we've almost never seen before in previous conflicts. The war on terror has made these almost normal.
Well,
when you go to a funeral of someone that's been killed, you could be then killed yourself.
Well, that's pretty common all over the world, I'm afraid.
It is
now. I mean, don't forget that after the end of the Afghan war, the Taliban only came to power because the warlords who fought to control Afghanistan at the end of the war, all of whom had been armed and trained by our special forces, they decided to indiscriminately bomb Kabul. And it went on for ages, and the whole place was reduced to rubble, and hundreds and thousands of people were killed. So I don't, human life has become very, very cheap, especially for poor people in poor countries, hasn't it?
I mean, it's particularly horrific in the Middle East, where a lot of this stuff is happening, and that's where we focus now, because we had a report last week from Stephen Sizer. If you missed the show, you can go back and listen again, or thisweek.org.uk to grab that. In fact, I put a version of it up onto YouTube as well, which you should be able to find on my Public Inquiry YouTube channel. But that was with Stephen Sizer. He's the Virginia Water in Surrey vicar, the Church of England vicar, that retired at Easter, but he was banned, Martin, by his bishop for posting a link to an article, 9/11, Israel did it, all the proof in the world.
Well, there's lots of evidence to suggest that Mossad had a hand in it. They didn't do it on their own, they did it with their allies in the Western intelligence structure, including our own MI6.
So you're talking about you're really seriously saying that somebody like the FBI, it would be in the United States, that's supposed to stop any kind of foreign terrorist activity in the United States, the FBI directors, people like that, would have known about 9/11?
Look, we know an awful lot more about it than we knew at the time, and the evidence is over.
There was a guy called John O'Neill, wasn't he? Deputy Director of the FBI.
John O'Neill, Deputy Director of the FBI, pointed the finger, and he eventually died on the day because he'd become Director of Security at the World Trade Center. The FBI...
Let's just focus on John O'Neill for a minute, because he had said he was following a lot of the people that later supposedly went on to do the 9/11 attacks, but he was told to lay off, even though he was the number two at the FBI, that he shouldn't follow these people around.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, what we suspect...
And he resigned as a result.
He resigned, that's right. And he gave a press conference in France with Brissard and Daski, who were both French former intelligence officers, saying that, you know, basically, whenever we try and get to the bottom of who Al-Qaeda is, we're told to back off. Because Al-Qaeda, effectively, is a wing of the... deep state in the US with their Saudi and Israeli allies. I mean, isn't that so obvious now?
I mean, Martin, after all these years? Weeks ago, you were saying on here that the FBI are involved actually in fomenting terrorism in the United States. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, there's a study came out, and we put a link to it later. It's by lawyers in the US. They point out that 95% of the people convicted of terrorism and offences in the US have been entrapped. That is to say, the FBI creates the terrorist plot and then recruits people to it, and then they arrest them just before they carry them out. Although what the other 5% are is the people where the plots are carried out, but they all end up dead. There's absolute clear evidence from the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which actually went to trial, that the FBI supplied the explosives which were used, which killed 6 civilians. And the FBI supplied the explosives and allowed that attack to take place and then arrested everybody and said,
I mean,
look at this terrible
plot. It's
almost
like you're saying that these crime agencies that are supposed to stop crime are actually largely run by organized crime.
Well, that's right. And of course, everybody in Latin America is very well aware that the army and the police are in the pocket of the drug traffickers, and they're all in the pocket of the CIA. There's a fantastic four-part documentary on the History Channel at the moment, America's War on Drugs, which basically details in full detail, for anybody who's interested, the CIA's role in the drug trade over the last 50 years. And they've been central to it all the way.
Well, Gary Webb,
and central to terrorism as well.
Gary Webb exposed it. He was the US journalist, and then he was supposed to have committed suicide, but there was a suspicion, wasn't there?
Well, there's 2 shots to the back of the head because he missed the first time. That's what you do when you commit suicide, eh?
But he'd exposed, I think it was in the San Jose Mercury, that
there's a film called Dark Alliance, which is a Hollywood film about all of this.
So very close links between these intelligence services, CIA, FBI, and organised crime. I mean, if you go
and
back,
terrorism, because they're all linked.
And if you go back to the JFK assassination, quite clearly, the CIA and the FBI. Now we know. If you go back and even look at Mark Lane's the lawyer's books at the time, it was quite clear. And we did a special on this show on the 50th anniversary back in 2013, about the JFK assassination, that Lyndon Johnson was in on it, Hoover at the FBI was, and whoever the boss of the CIA was, all at the same time. And
H.W. Bush, who was actually in Dallas on the day.
He wasn't actually the CIA director, though, was he?
He was second in command, I believe.
Yeah, he was there on the day. So these people, so long as you've got the people who are in heads of these agencies, in on the crime, then they can actually steer the cover up, can't they? I wonder whether similar sorts of things are possible here in Britain with our recent terrorist attacks.
Yes, they're very definitely possible. And we suspect, I mean, it may be that that you've just got random nutters, but I mean, I read about the London Bridge attackers. One of them definitely fought in Libya and Syria, and therefore presumably had contact with our intelligence services and special forces, who are basically the recruiters and enablers for the jihadis in Libya and Syria. Whether they then lost control of them and then they attack civilians in the West, oh dear, what a shame. But the suspicion has got to be that this is all being directed by the intelligence services, which is why we need independent police forces who are going to independently investigate it, like in Italy and like the police service of Northern Ireland, who are going to look at the intelligence services and say, if you're criminals, we are going to feel your collar.
Oh, looking at this war on terror, it's lovely to see after, well, gosh, where are we now? 16 years since it was declared by George W. Bush, the 9/11, just after the 9/11 attacks, that some politicians are saying it's not working. But let's go back now to have a look at the 9/11 attacks through the eyes of the former head of the US Army War College. And this guy's name is Alan Sabrosky.
What we need to stand up and say is not only did they attack the USS Liberty, they did 9/11. They did it. I have had long conversations over the past 2 weeks with contacts at the Army War College, at its headquarters, Marine Corps, and I've made it absolutely clear in both cases that it is 100% certain that 9/11 was a Mossad operation. I don't denigrate what happened to USS Liberty in the slightest. You understand that. But for most Americans, what happened to the USS Liberty or in Vietnam was history. They can be concerned about it, but they're not going to get mad about it. 9/11 has led directly to 60,000 Americans dead and wounded. God knows how many hundreds of thousands of people in other countries that we've killed or wounded or made homeless. And it's an ongoing sore. It's not your sore from the USS Liberty. It's not my sore from Vietnam. Both of us have those. Both of us care about it. But this is an open wound. And what Americans need to understand is they did it. They did it. And if they do understand that, Israel's going to disappear. Israel will flat-ass disappear from this earth. I sent a film to one of my colleagues, and it basically had Americans grieving over their dead, coming back. And I showed one of them, it was a woman wrenched by grief over her dead soldier. And I said, you know, if Americans ever know that Israel did this, they're going to scrub them off the earth, and they're not going to give a rat's ass, forgive my language, what the cost is. They are not going to care. They will do it.
Alan, you
and
know...
And they should.
Alan, your article needs to be shipped off to the Library of Congress immediately.
Well, I can tell you it's being read by some people in Headquarters Marine Corps and at the Army War College. I sent it off to them this past week, and I've had some long discussions with people up there, and there are some really, really unhappy people.
Okay.
The first thing, Mark, is astonishment. They didn't know. They truly didn't know. And these are not unintelligent people. They really didn't know. And the next statement is rage. Real rage. The Zionists are playing this as truly an all-or-nothing exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they lose this one, if the American people ever realize what's
right.
happened,
mm-hmm.
they're done.
That's it.
You know, I have one grandparent who's Jewish. If Americans ever truly understand that, they're history. You know, it'll be a bloody, brutal war, and they're gone. It's not even going to be a close contest. And they know that, and what they understand, I think, as well, is that their leverage is on the political appointments. Their leverage is not in the uniformed services. If you pick up the Army Times or the Navy Times or any of the journals of any of the services, you get a very different view than you get, you know, looking at the Congress and the White House. The military has not been bought. The military is loyal, but it has not been bought.
That's Colonel Alan Sabrowski, former head of the U.S. Army War College there, absolutely nailing the 9/11 attacks onto the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, the Israeli government, Martin. He's even saying there that he believes that Israel should be wiped out. He said it should be wiped out for what it's done.
Well, yes, and of course, one of the key things was the so-called five dancing Israelis who were filming the attack, eventually arrested, and then they said, oh, well, sorry, we were just it turned out they were Mossad agents. They went on TV in Israel and said, oh, we were just documenting the attack. But it's a surprise attack. How did you know? So, in other words, that's one of the smoking guns that points to Israeli involvement in 9/11. But I think Alan Sabrowski himself would realise that the Israelis couldn't have done that without a fifth column operating within the CIA, etc. I think he's quite clear. I mean, if the ordinary people in America do realise that the Israelis were big players in carrying out 9/11, then they're likely to be a bit cross, aren't they?
They certainly are. Well, we're taking a sort of step back from this 16-year-old war on terror tonight, bashing our fists on the table saying it's bonkers, it's never going to work, it's all wrong. And someone that's been doing that almost since the beginning is the author of a book about the September the 11th attacks. His name is Webster Tarpley. Now, Martin, Webster Tarpley takes a pretty dim view of it all, and he did right from the start, didn't he?
Yes, Tarpley would say that it's elements within the U.S. security structure cooperating with the Israelis. He wouldn't just blame the Israelis.
He was actually saying synthetic terror made in the USA was the title of his book. What does he mean by synthetic terror?
Well, he's basically pointed. I mean, it's what we've said on this show many times, the whole concept of a strategy of tension. So terrorist attacks happen, evil Muslims, evil communists, evil fascists, whoever it is, either carrying out individual attacks or big spectacular attacks on 9/11. And this, of course, is a power play by the intelligence services, the military and the oligarchy. And Webster Tarpley's a very, very highly educated PhD, Dr. Webster Tarpley. He's a historian, massive IQ, the size of a planet, and a lot of what he says makes an awful lot of sense.
He likes plates of cheese and ham, he eats, doesn't he?
That's right, he doesn't do carbohydrates.
Well, we met him because we did a tour a few years ago now, gosh, a long time ago, which was Guy Fawkes to 9/11.
Yeah, he's a very interesting...
What was the connection between Guy Fawkes and
9/11? Well, with Guy Fawkes, the Guy Fawkes point is that there was no real gunpowder plot. This is now widely accepted by historians. The gunpowder plot had been created by Robert Cecil, who was the spy master for the state, in order to
Elizabeth
set the Catholics
first?
Up. Elizabeth no, it was
first,
already or? James I
by
was
James
stage.
I, okay.
And so basically, and that, the gunpowder had even been provided by the government to the plotters. The plotters were genuine plotters, but they didn't realise that they were being led up the garden path by the secret services, and that's why they were all arrested and hung, drawn and quartered, etc. Very similar to what the FBI have been doing in the United States, where they set things up and then suddenly everybody's arrested, because in actual fact they've been doing it all along in order to set up the Muslim community. But of course in that particular case, they're setting up the Catholic community to be the enemy within, to strengthen the Protestant state, which had been established in Britain not that long before.
Well, what about the role of Islam today in this war on terror? Because we've got a definite attempt to attack these Muslim countries through Afghanistan, etc. But then Turkey, it's very difficult because Turkey has always been part of NATO, but it's an Islamic country. It seems, as we reported last week, they've now ordered these S-400 missile systems from the Russians. So how can a NATO country be ordering a Russian-made anti-aircraft
system?
Well,
what the Turks are doing is playing what you would do in their position, is playing one off against the other. They're part of NATO, and as the Russians pointed out, the evidence is overwhelming that Bilal Erdogan's son was involved in bringing massive amounts of oil out of the ISIS-controlled areas of Syria, making a huge profit on it, and then it was being resold onto Israel, where they got very cheap oil from ISIS.
But what it suggests to me is that the Turkish government are more worried about US aircraft overflying their country than they are about Russians.
Well, don't forget there was an attempted coup against Erdogan from within the armed forces, which the Erdogan regime...
That was 11 months ago.
Yeah, well, they're pretty convinced that was carried out by the CIA. So, inevitably, they're not that happy about that.
Or not carried out by the CIA.
Well, it failed.
And
it failed because the Russians tipped them off. And the Russians actually rescued... Erdogan was supposed to be shot down. His plane was supposed to be shot down, but the Russians tipped him off. So he escaped.
The Americans are in a similar position in Qatar, in a way, aren't they? Because they've got a very important CENTCOM base in Qatar. Mm-hmm. They've also got the Intelik Air Base in Turkey. So they're kind of surrounded by people who are, in the future, maybe potentially their enemies.
Well, after the coup, the base, the Intelik base, was completely surrounded by the Turkish armed forces.
And they switched the electricity off, didn't they?
Yeah. So this is very similar to the run-up to World War One, but it's on steroids and it's happening very, very
fast.
What
are the similarities between World War One and this?
Well, because you've got all of these different kaleidoscopes of alliances. Everybody's been fighting now since 9/11, and the whole thing really is about to go up, where major powers are going to go to war with each other and lots more people are going to be killed. It's absolutely mad, but we've managed to work ourselves into this position. And, of course, the population as a whole are either asleep or terrified. They just when you get under the duvet, or like Tommy Robinson earlier, they want to lash out at the Muslim community, even though in actual fact the Muslim terrorists are foot soldiers for our own intelligence services.
Now,
evidence is overwhelming.
A lot of people are saying that the Muslims are the new Jews, that this is attack which is similar to Goebbels' propaganda campaign against the Jews.
Yeah, but this is a perfect... The CIA years ago worked out that most of the resources they want, particularly oil, are in Muslim countries. So if we create a kind of anti-Muslim attitude, then that gives us carte blanche to invade Muslim countries to take their resources. And that's what this is all about. That's what it's all about. That's what it's always been about.
So, I mean, what's the conclusion you would draw if you're comparing Goebbels and the Nazis' propaganda campaign against Jews in the 1930s and our own government and our own media, particularly the Murdoch media, this kind of thing, their campaign against Muslims now, and you know, people like,
well, the modern Sun.
The modern
manipulation is much more sophisticated than what went on in the 1930s. In the 1930s, there was no internet, there was no TV. They relied upon the radio and newspapers and, creating incidents like the Reichstag fire in order to create enemies, the enemies within, and so on. But in actual fact, of course, a lot of Nazi intelligence officers were absorbed into NATO in the 40s, and that this whole idea of psychological warfare, strategic communications, we can get what we want through deception and the manipulation of violence has become absolutely the modus operandi of NATO intelligence services.
You know what, Martin, I'm going to put up another link on this week's show page to that excellent article by The Saker, who we interviewed at Christmas and New Year, didn't we? Where he talks about 80% of the effort in modern warfare is going into psychological warfare. That is controlling what we see.
That's
in
right.
Here.
It's not what happens. It's what people think has happened. That's what it's all about. But of course, if we do get to a real fight, as we may do now, we'll soon see whether NATO's kit is up to it, because the Russians have actually got, they've been preparing to fight for a long time.
Okay, so what role does economic warfare play? Because that he talks about as 15% of modern warfare is.
Well, that's very important, isn't it? I mean, the sanctions against Russia, which were reiterated this week, because they're trying in the US, they're pushing for more sanctions because they're trying to stop the Nord Stream pipeline, which will bring gas directly to Germany. And Germany and Austria want that gas, but the Americans don't want it to happen, so they're creating sanctions against the Russians to prevent it from happening. Economic warfare is one step from real warfare. I mean, if you know, the sanctions on Iraq after the first Gulf War killed thousands and thousands of Iraqis. We've still got sanctions on Syria today, so they find it virtually impossible to get hold of medicines and so on for their people. And in Yemen, we've got a blockade, which we are helping. The Royal Navy is helping to blockade Yemen so that we can starve them into submission to help the Saudi royal family. That's an act of war. And as I said earlier, if British military personnel are in Saudi Arabia involved in this and some missile lands on their head, then the world should cheer, because I'm not a pacifist. People have to fight sometimes, don't they?
Martin, so I mentioned Webster Tarpley. His analysis is a little bit like the Orwellian analysis, isn't it? George Orwell's analysis, saying that this idea of a permanent war.
Well, yes.
Well, let's have a listen to him now.
So the notion of a U.S. war on terrorism is simply a fraud. There is no war on terrorism. The Anglo-Americans are backing terrorists exactly when and where it suits them, from Chechnya to Cuba, to other points around the world. This is a typical British strategy. You've got to know the name of Brigadier General Sir Frank Kitson. He was the British operations officer in Kenya at the time of the Mau Mau. And what Kitson saw, which has been known to commanders for centuries, millennia, if you've got an underground nationalist organization and you want to discredit them, you create your own parallel underground nationalist organization. You send them out, it's got to have the same name, it's got to have a false flag. You send them out, have it commit tremendous atrocities. Those will be blamed on the original, relatively benign group, and they'll be discredited, they'll be demonized, and you gain political advantage. He wrote a book about it called Low Intensity Operations. The technique is called the technique of the counter gang or the pseudo-gang. Just as Al-Qaeda, in the broader sense, is a pseudo-gang or counter-gang created by U.S. and British and Israeli intelligence, it's a counter-gang against normal Arab nationalists or anybody with any positive agenda for reform or independence or development anywhere in the Arab world. They can always be labeled Al-Qaeda. The reductio ad absurdum of this is President Chavez of Venezuela, after giving Bush a hard time at various conferences and doing things to undermine the dollar, the neocons accuse President Chavez of being a member of Al-Qaeda. So you can see how easy it is to demonize somebody once you've got a good counter gang going. There's an oligarchical consensus in the United States inspired by the neocons, inspired by Samuel Huntington and the rest of them, which is that without an enemy image, you cannot have an oligarchical society. Ultimately, that's the why. Because if you look at this, you say, terrorism, endless war, why, who benefits? Those who benefit are the beneficiaries of the current system, financiers primarily. They feel that without the diversion of a war, they cannot maintain social relations, property relations in the current form. And this they are determined to do. So they have manufactured, in a complete hysteria, a largely fictitious external enemy. You remember 1984 by George Orwell. Julia at one point says, I don't even think there is a war. It's just a fake to keep people under control. Orwell, I think, had a very good understanding of some of these psychological mechanisms.
The war is not meant to be won. It is meant to be continuous. The essential act of modern warfare is the destruction of the produce of human labor. A hierarchical society is only possible on the basis of poverty and ignorance. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact.
That's a clip from 1984 there, Martin. It does seem that that's where we are, doesn't it, right now, is in this situation where we are simply in this war, and the media is trying to make us think that we're trying to win it, but actually we're not. We just want it to carry on forever.
Yes, and that would be presuming that the terrorists are genuine terrorists, and that's what it actually suits us for them to carry on.
Now,
but of course,
Netanyahu,
what we suspect is that the terrorists are actually working directly with our own security forces.
And
I think in Libya and Syria, that's indisputably the case.
Netanyahu wrote this book back in the 1980s, in fact, he edited it, called Terrorism, How the West Can Win. And he, of course, and many of the fellow leaders in Israel were ex-terrorists themselves, so they should
know. Well, indeed, yes, they invented both the car bomb and the letter bomb.
So what is the technique, do you think? How can the West win using terrorism? Reading between the lines, what's he saying?
Well, the purpose of all of this is what they call fourth-generation warfare, which and Mossad likes to boast about how tricksy they are by deception to make war. And they can't help boasting about their clever little tricks sometimes. But then we're supposed to believe that these people have got genuine, peaceful intentions. They're just defending themselves against the evil Arabs. In actual fact, of course, it's come out this week that the Israelis are supplying weaponry and training to jihadi terrorists, Sunni jihadi terrorists in Syria to fight the Syrian army, and that's because they and of course these jihadi Syrian Sunni jihadis, the ISIS apologised to the Israelis the other day for attacking one of their patrols, said we're sorry, we didn't mean to do that, and the Israeli defence minister said of course we accepted their apology because ISIS and Israel and the West are all on the same side. And I'm quite sure that Bashar Assad and Putin and Khomeini, they all know this. The dogs in the street know it in the Middle East. Tell Tommy Robinson.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Coming to talk about Freemasonry now, Martin, the Premier Grand Lodge of England was founded on the 24th of June 1717 as the Grand Lodge of London and Westminster, and was the first Masonic Grand Lodge to be created in the world. In 1813, it united with something else called the Ancient Grand Lodge of England, which I don't know if that was older. They don't tell you that, but to create the United Grand Lodge of England. The basic principles were inspired by the idea that mankind in the universe determines its own course without God's intervention, and that differing views are healthy and should be tolerated. And also it was characterised by the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century. I mean, this whole idea of different views is surely a good thing.
Well, the history of Masonry is that in the 18th century, people like Mozart and Beethoven became Masons, and because they were the progressives, they were the educated classes. They weren't nobility. They didn't have traditional kind of power. And the Freemason lodges were very active in the run-up to the French Revolution.
So they were saying effectively that the church was holding back progress.
Yes, I mean they're basically, you know, the whole idea of secret societies, not just the Masons. The Carbonari, for example, were the nationalist secret society in Italy, and they became very, you know, the way they operated became very popular, and you got students all over Europe at the universities, mostly men, of course, forming secret societies to liberate Germany, to liberate France, to liberate Portugal, whatever. And the Masons at that stage were part of, you know, that kind of progressive movement.
Well,
it
was called the Enlightenment from 1700 roughly to 1800, referred to by its participants as the Age of Reason. Enlightenment thinkers in Britain, France and throughout Europe questioned biblical authority, embraced this notion that humanity can be improved through secular or religious experiment, discovery and rational change. Also, you mentioned the French Revolution, also the American Revolution, directly inspired by Enlightenment ideals, apparently, and respectively marked the peak of its influence, the revolutions were.
Yes, I mean, and they still exist, but of course, when Freemasonry first came on the scene, it represented the ideology of the go-ahead middle classes, the people who wanted change in society and believed in reason rather than superstition and so on. But of course, the modern Masons are very much embedded in the same structures as our secret services and the financiers and the oligarchs.
And
they're just another brick in the wall.
What about some of these figures who were involved in the Enlightenment? John Locke, Tom Paine, Voltaire, any thoughts about them?
Well, I don't know which of any of those were actual Masons, but I think the thing about the Masons was the secrecy with which they operated, but they felt that they had to operate secretly, particularly in places like Italy, because the state, you know, didn't like their ideas.
I mean, Napoleon, for example, I mean, he was a product of the French Revolution. He was really seen as a threat by the British, wasn't he? I mean, he also seen as an atheist, and there was this whole, well, you know, here's the godless Napoleon around the world, killing everybody.
Well, the French Revolution is, you know, a big event in world history, still influencing things today. The Freemasonry played a role in it, but the idea that it was all, you see, the right wing after the crushing of Napoleon took the view that the Masons were, you know, the heart of the problem. So there was a very anti-Masonic attitude from the Vatican. Franco, for example, in Spain in the 30s used to be pretty brutal towards anybody he thought was a Freemason. So the Masons have played different roles at different times. And in Italy in the 1980s and 1970s, P2, the top lodge in Italy, was heavily involved in Operation Gladio, in the Strategia di Tensione.
Effectively, what they're doing is they're saying, well, we have a secret combination here, and we're going to be running things from behind the scenes. Effectively, that's what they were doing in Italy with all the newspapers, the bankers, the heads of the political parties, etc., meeting in secret to decide the country's future.
That's right. So, you know, but you can see that Masonry, in fact, is a very plastic phenomenon. It changes historically, it changes in its different contexts, and if Masonry didn't exist, the elites would create something else similar. Skull and Bones in the US is not a Mason organisation, but it's a very powerful organisation. Council on Foreign Relations isn't Masonry, but it's another powerful organisation. Bilderberg isn't Masonry, although there are many Masons in it. They will create structures in which to carry out their plots. They've always done it, and they're still doing it today.
Also, I mean, let's look at some of the people we know of Freemasons. One, starting with the guy I mentioned earlier, this Anders Behring Breivik. There's pictures of him in his Masonic outfit, and it's bizarre that they said that he was acting alone, because clearly he had very close secret associations with other members of his lodge.
Well, what we suspect about that, as you well know, is that he wasn't acting alone, and that he's actually part of an Operation Gladio structure in Scandinavia, which led to the assassination of Olof Palme, the Prime Minister of Sweden, because, you know, basically Swedish Scandinavian social democracy is a threat to capitalist extremism, and therefore these countries have got to be destabilised.
Another couple of Freemasons recently convicted the man who managed to squeeze £375,000 worth of compensation. A police superintendent, Gordon Anglesey, was then found to have been abusing kids, and he managed to squeeze that compensation out of newspapers that had reported the truth.
Yeah, well, the whole thing about paedophilia is it's used for blackmail. That's what that's all about.
Also, Philip Judd, who was the Western Supermere mayor, who was recently jailed for paedophilia, also turned out he was the master of a lodge down in Weston.
Well, I don't think it's accidental that you've got paedophilia associated with these networks. It's not just because people have got nasty habits. It's also because it's a for purposes of blackmail. We've got to recognise that there's a very, very dark side to our society.
And this is a good way of keeping it all secret, of course. Anyway, we're finished now with a clip from a programme put out by Jeremiah Films. I think it was around about 2000. And Mike Mandel, who says that the Masonic rituals involved are very, very similar to those of various other types of occult rituals, including witchcraft.
I spoke with a number of former Masons and compared their Blue Lodge initiations with the experiences of former occultists.
In the initiation in Freemasonry, we had to be recommended by another Mason.
Well, in order to join witchcraft, you have to be recommended by somebody currently in witchcraft.
Well, when I was initiated, I was blindfolded and bound by rope, and on your bare chest was thrust the point of a spear.
In witchcraft, we were initiated. The candidate was led blindfolded, bound by a rope, to the edge of the magic circle.
And the rope is around your neck and your lid forward. And up front, in the eastern end of the building, is a person who's a worshipful master. And you kneel down before him as if he were a god.
You are met by the high priest or high priestess with a sword to your chest.
When I went to enter the lodge, a sharp object was put to my left breast. And I was warned that should I reveal any of the secrets of Freemasonry, to know what to expect.
When you're presented before the high priest, a sword is held against your chest, and you actually take a blood oath, promising to remain faithful to the secrets of witchcraft.
Well, when you are in the room, this blindfold is taken away from you, and this is a time when they say that you're coming from darkness into light.
During the initiation ceremony, the initiate is led by the lieutenant of the high priest and is challenged at the edge of the circle by someone saying, "Who goes there?" And the answer is, "One from the world of darkness."
In Masonry, the prayers are ended with, "So mote it be."
We would always end any spell or ritual where we released the power, this is where the power was released, with the word, "So mote it be."
Some of the parallels between Freemasonry and witchcraft show such a similarity that it cannot possibly be coincidental. Similarities in ritual, wording, and symbolism are so close in several instances that it clearly suggests a common origin.
So the Masons say, Martin, that they were started 300 years ago tomorrow. It does look as if it's got something much sort of deeper roots than that.
Well, what happens is that people copy other people's rituals. It's been going on throughout history and prehistory. Skull and Bones have a similar set of rituals, but they're not Masons, they're Skull and Bones. But everybody uses the same kind of rituals. It's actually rooted in the secret societies in Italy during the Risorgimento, the unification of Italy, the Carbonari. And they became very popular, and everybody around Europe copied their way of doing things with these kind of blood-curdling oaths and so on. The Tolpuddle Martyrs were sent to prove
something. There's
something
wrong with a club, surely, that says, if you breathe a word of what goes on here, we're going to kill you.
Well, I believe that those who join the Provisional IRA have to make a similar
commitment. From this myth that it's 300 years, I mean, there's these orders of chivalry which go back much further, and even further back from that, things like the Knights Templar, which had
What happened is that the Masons in the 18th century invented a history for themselves going back to ancient Egypt, but it was an invented history. People invent stuff all the time. They make it up and they copy each other. Yeah,
like the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail,
exactly.
The bloodline of Christ, the great secret turns out to be a load of nonsense.
Well, exactly. Everybody copies other people's theatres.
Anyway, Martin, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now, coming up live on Facebook. Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi, maybe
this
during Ramadan.
BCFM.
Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Elena Comely. Also, you'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Our show page is thisweek.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless. Don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.